Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Noel. Today we're going to learn about a non-hot pepper that will protect your liver, improve your blood sugar, and reduce your weight gain. From the National Agri-Food Biotechnique Institute in Punjab University in India, we have about 10 more. But then the majority of our program today will be focused upon an in-depth, original investigative report. It is now posted. It is entitled The Unscientific Scientific America. Richard Gale and I, this has been fully vetted for academic accuracy and scholarship and legally. So this is one more way we're challenging the establishment that controls virtually everything and is censoring the truth on matters of health and the environment and science. And I don't know if additional time will allow, but if it does, we have a few things to discuss concerning our democracy no longer represents the people. And a professor, Larry Lessig, L-E-S-S-I-G, from Harvard, will share his thoughts. If we don't have time today, we'll do it on the next one. Plus, we have a new report continuing the dangers of 5G technology. So we have a lot to share. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. And in this respect, a lot of people have a problem eating hot peppers. They're simply insensitive to it. They end up with some mouth ulcers. And even though the vast majority of people are actually benefited from inflammation in the body. Now that seems like an oxymoron. You're taking in something very hot, but your body already has hot systems around that are causing massive inflammation. But it does work. But this is new because spicy peppers are known to aid in weight loss. There ain't known lots of scientific literature on how they can turn off pain, especially in your joints and muscles. However, not everybody can tolerate their taste. The good news is there's a milder and more palatable alternative. It is a dihydrocapsaicate. That's D-I-H-Y-D-R-O-C-A-P-S-I-A-T-E. And it's simply a compound that belongs to the capsaicinoid family, of which all red peppers do. And it is structurally related to the compound capsaicin, but is present in non-pungent peppers. And it really is good in protecting your liver, and if you're diabetic, protecting your blood sugar from spiking. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition Research. So that's good. Just one more thing. And you can buy this simply as a powder or as a capsule. It's that simple. Make it real easy for you. Good research done at UCLA on this also. From Wake Forest School of Medicine, they ask a question, can we beat Alzheimer's with aerobic exercise? Now, is aerobic exercise the right prescription for staving off Alzheimer's? Researchers are prescribing exercise as if it were a drug in a study that aims to see if it can prevent Alzheimer's disease. And they're testing it to see what is the outcome. And this is funded by the National Institutes in Aging. And it could help determine whether exercise can protect people from memory and thinking problems associated with Alzheimer's. Now, that's the study that they're doing. Here's the irony. There are hundreds of studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing that exercise lengthens our lifespan substantially, depending upon the regularity and the distance and intensity of our exercise. And that's why I always suggest you start off slow, let your body, after stretching, get nice and relaxed and warm, and then pick your pace up, and then really get aerobic. And you know you're aerobic when you can't talk when you're exercising. And then you slow it down. But before you do that, you do one intense burst. It's true in a gym, on a stationary bicycle, out on the road. It's that burst that really makes a difference. And in any case, it lengthens the telomeres. And the length of our telomeres, the end caps of our chromosomes, determine how long that system's going to live. So if, perchance, you have not exercised, you can take about 9 years off your lifespan or more. But if you have, you can extend the lifespan. Now, it's turning off inflammation, also increasing better circulation, especially to the brain and the microcapillary system in the ankles and feet. And that's why a lot of people have little purple splotchy and spider veins. Poor circulation is frequently a part of that. In any case, the question is not, do we need another study to determine something that is already self-evident in the scientific literature? We know it works. So, but someone's making money off a research grant, and those things just never stop being churned out. From the University of Pennsylvania, music can be a viable alternative to medications in reducing anxiety before anesthesia. And this study found that music to be similarly effective as the intravenous form of the sedative medication in lowering anxiety before procedure. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. So music. Also from the Sanger Institute and Cambridge University, low doses of radiation, and they're promoted as being good and necessary and safe. They're not. You've been lied to. Low doses of radiation promote cancer-capable cells. In fact, some people get CAT scans on a regular basis where there's no real indication it's needed. And they're considered safe. They are not. There's no such thing as a safe CT or CAT scan. And they give cancer-capable cells a competitive advantage over normal cells in healthy tissue. That's what they discovered at Cambridge in this study. So just like we told you, low-dose alcohol was bad, low-dose radiation is bad as well. And this was published in one of their journals, Cell Stem Cells. So unless it's absolutely necessary, and get three opinions, is there another way of determining what you need to know without me getting an x-ray? From Baylor College of Medicine comes a study about carnitine. Carnitine, C-A-R-N-I-T-I-N-E. When you're low in it, it's linked to a mild form of autism. Now, this is interesting because when I'm working with people diagnosed with autism, I'm working on two phenomena simultaneously. I'm working on re-energizing the mitochondria in the gut and then re-energizing the heart, giving it more energy, and the brain more energy, because carnitine not only helps give energy to the heart, but also the brain. And that's why it's good for people that think a lot, people that exercise a lot. You should always take carnitine before you exercise. And people who use their brains a lot. That would be about four Americans right now. So carnitine is important, especially if you don't want to end up with some form of mild autism. And if you have someone with it, then look at carnitine as part of that overall helpful protocol. And so, in fact, this study was published in BioEssays. Now, Ruhr University in Germany says that passive Facebook use is correlated with depressive symptoms. Okay, let's see this. Great holiday, fantastic party, adorable children, incredible food. Everybody shows their life in the best light on social networks. I know someone right now that has become virtually obsessed, almost possessed with the idea that their pet is the most adorable thing in the world and will be the next blockbuster film being made. I'm talking about obsessive. And I had to say, hold on, you're sending me too many pictures. I don't need to see all this. But when someone is obsessed, their view of the world collapses inward to their need. And then you have to find out, what is your real need? What is the need that is unrequited and not being met, that you're using all these pictures of your cat or dog as a substitute? Now, they won't get it. They'll frequently argue with you. They become highly defensive. But then think about all the pictures on Facebook. What are they really telling us about the people who need to share them? Constantly. Well, then what about the person's need to be on that network? And then it's about developing depressive symptoms. So I think it's important. This is an article from Behavior and Information Technology, that we're just overusing the internet, we're overusing all these social media as a way of showing who we are through what we ate for breakfast. And here's my latest hat that I just bought. What do you think? Let me have likes. This is sad. It's not pathetic, it's sad. It's sad that people have so depersonalized the intimacy of their being that they've reduced themselves to how many likes they can get in shares on a social medium, all of which is artificial. None of it is real. But that's where we're at, and that's why a lot of people are lonely and don't know how to relate to people one-on-one anymore. From Cornell University, researchers find chronic fatigue syndrome is linked to gut health. Good that they finally caught up with the rest of us. Isn't it interesting? Think of this for a moment. When I was at the very beginning of my career, and I had my first best-selling book, and I was invited out to Phoenix for a lecture, and I was on a tour. I was lecturing all across America, and that was my last stop. And I'd been out for about 38 days. The publisher kept saying, well, we got another place we want you. And I'd been on all the major nationals, Johnny Carson, all those shows, Mike Douglas. And when I got there, it was boiling hot. It was the middle of the summer. And I won't go through all the stuff that I had to contend with. I ended up staying in a trailer with no air conditioner or fan even, and having to hike back into town. The backstory I'll save for a book later on. But it was a rough go. And then the person who did all the deal, who brought me in there with the publisher, said, I'm very angry. I said, what about? He said, well, your publisher said I can't return any books, and we never do that, you know, and we normally order 50 books for, you know, Pavlo Roll or someone like that coming to lecture. And he had us order 500 books. And I said, okay, I'll do this. I'll buy the 500 books that you paid for him. In return, he said he only had about 9 people sign up for my lecture. I said, I'll just go ahead and take over the lecture. You don't have to attend. Whatever comes in, you know, if it's 4 or 5, it's mine. Okay. Well, he hadn't promoted it. And then I went around and started promoting the heck out of it. I went to all the television radio stations, and what I did not know, I had no idea that some of the pre-recorded programs that I had done, the big shows, began to play. And then they tagged that, well, Gary Noll is going to be at such and such. This is so funny. So on the night of the lecture, I wear this white outfit because everything else I had was soaked. And I got into town, and I got there in the back of a truck. And I'm thinking, this is not good. I'm going to be so dirty. And I walked into the door, and I went in a room, and there were, like, I'm guessing around 12 people. And I think, okay, well, that's better than 7, right? And so I sat down, and I said, why don't we make a circle, and we'll talk about whatever's interesting to you. Ask me any question you want. I'm happy to be here to share with you. And I didn't get any response. So I said, well, do you have anything personally, anything with your health? I'm here to help. No, not a word. So I thought, okay, what can I do? Let me do a discussion about a balanced plant-based diet. So I began to talk, and about 5 minutes into this talk, I hear Gary, and I turn around, and he says, "What are you doing?" "I'm giving my lecture." He says, "You're in the wrong place." I said, "Well, I came in the door. This is the back door. Nobody comes in the back door. These are people that don't speak English. They're not part of this." "Okay, I didn't know. So, and you're late. You know, this was supposed to start 20 minutes ago. Thank goodness." And I walked in this room, and oh, my God, you would have got such a kick out of this. This is one of those moments that in life that's the entire civic auditorium was packed. Well, not a seat taken. I got some pictures of this up on my website. You can see it. You can see my hair is long, and I got this white suit on. But then the people who had filled in for me were Dr. Padla Arola. For the older people in this audience, you'll recognize the name, and Dr. Walker. Dr. Walker was America's most famous herbalist. And I guess he was around 90 at the time, and they did a great job entertaining people before I got up there. And I was just laughing to myself when Pablo was introducing me. And he turned out to be a genuinely decent human being, a very kind person. But afterwards, we went out together, had some dinner, and they spent several hours telling me about the future of the health movement. They were spot on. I mean, they were absolutely accurate. They didn't live to see it. But they talked about holistic health before the word holistic was even mentioned in the vocabulary. It wasn't in our vernacular. And so today, when I look at chronic fatigue, I'm looking at how chronic fatigue was helped back then, because we had fatigue back then. And there were doctors helping people with fatigue. And some of those doctors were natural hygienists. And they were fasting the people, and they were rebalancing their gut bacteria. And there was one place down in San Antonio, Texas, I went down to see this guy, and he had people drinking fermented juices all day long. They were fasting on fermented juices, and I was hearing their testimonials. They were remarkable testimonials, and yet the rest of the world would never have known about that. He was doing more with probiotics than anyone else in the United States 50 years before probiotics became popular. So chronic fatigue also has a whole phenomenon going on in the gut. So clean up the gut, provide the body with healthy bacteria, and you can improve chronic fatigue syndrome. And especially if you follow a principle that I call the laws of compensation. And I'll just give you a very brief overview. I'm not going in depth on it today. To the degree that you have any imbalance, it could be genetic, viral, bacterial, trauma, it could be emotional, it could be epigenetic, you have to exceed that so that you are able to collapse the dominant energy that's in our body and mind. And only once you're able to exceed it, then it automatically collapses, then you immediately go into a quantum healing state. Now, that seems like a gross oversimplification, but then why don't you ask the tens of thousands of people I've done that with, and it works. When you're hearing people on the radio giving testimonials, you know, like the woman yesterday who was crying, the woman from Greece who brought her son to the last retreat, and she said, I wasn't here for myself. I'm not into this. You know, but nothing would work. No, nothing the ophthalmologist said would work for my son's loss of his vision. He was going blind. And so I brought him here, and he began to improve. But more importantly, I couldn't walk because I had hip surgery, and they had done something wrong, and there was nerve damage. In any case, there was excruciating pain. They prevented this woman from sleeping and exercising. And she said that when her husband and her would go for a walk in a mall, every 50 feet she'd have to tell him, "I got to stop and rest," and she'd have to literally get in a chair and rest. So on the last day there, she went out for a walk, and along with several other people, and these were all people who came with major conditions, and they all did 26-mile marathon. And she kept going, and she thought she would walk 50 feet. That would be a big deal. She did a lot more than 50 feet. An hour later, she's just buzzing up and down this road, up and down. Now you can see the whole course, you can see them back and forth. And we had people out there, and physicians and nurses, in case anybody got tired, and they just get on a golf cart and we bring them back. So they were never out of vision. And what was amazing is that all the guests came down to the road to see this phenomenon, because nobody had ever seen very sick people who can barely walk suddenly doing 26 miles with ease and joyful and jumping and clapping and singing. And we filmed it. And here she comes up, and she's running, not walking, running. I mean, like a full sprint for half a mile. And she's, I don't know what happened. Well, what happened was that the dominant energy was collapsed by a different energy. More on that on upcoming discussions, because it takes a while to wrap your mind around quantum healing. In any case, from University of Manitoba, published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, artificial sweeteners are linked to the risk of weight gain and heart disease and a lot of other health problems. So stay away from these artificial sweeteners. And, well, on our next show, I'll talk about the anti-aging effects of Fistin. There's new research from the Salk Institute. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to come right back and have a in-depth discussion of how unscientific Scientific America magazine has become and why it's important you know this. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We are working nonstop, 7 days a week, all day, trying to challenge the all-inclusive control that the major corporations and the media, as their spokespersons and propagandists, have over almost every issue of our lives. And so we're taking on these one by one. Right now it's Wikipedia, but also today it's Wikipedia and the other media, including the scientific establishment. This article, which is posted on PRN.fm, is entitled Unscientific Scientific America. It was Aldous Huxley who said in 1958, a democracy depends upon the individuals making an intelligent and rational choice and what they regard as enlightened self-interest in any given circumstance. But the purposes of selling goods and the dictatorial propaganda is to try to bypass the rational side of man and to appeal directly to the unconscious forces below the surface so that you are, in a way, making nonsense of the whole democratic procedure, which is based upon a conscious choice on rational grounds. Many professionals and well-educated people read publications such as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Forbes, Mother Jones, The Nation, and leading newspapers such as The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal, with the assumption that their chief editors hold a high standard of journalistic integrity and objectivity. We assume these publications are not compromised by conflicts of interest and institutional indoctrination. It is in this that we end up seeing, is there something behind the scenes that we're not aware of, propelling let's say a domestic or an international agenda. And this is exactly the lead up to the invasion of Iraq that the New York Times writer Judith Miller promoted the falsehood of Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction. Readers believe that if such a storied journal, as in the New York Times, a paper, had a feature front page story, then it must be credible. In effect, Miller became a principal opinion leader for the Washington consensus establishment and the neocons to push forward with regime change. The media would play the role in convincing the public in the righteousness of this effort. Now, though the lie about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction was fabricated by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush and Condoleezza Rice and all the other neocons behind closed doors and subsequently leaked to the Times, the Bush administration was able to viably state, quote, see, even the New York Times has reported on Hussein's nuclear capabilities. Believe us, we are correct, end quote. But there were many credible and independent voices, such as former New York Times bureau chief in Cairo, Chris Hedges, Robert Perry, Cy Hirsch, professors Michael Chostkowski in Canada, and Noam Chomsky, and many more, who had conducted in-depth and unbiased research to question the White House and Miller's weapons of mass destruction claims. But their voices could never reach the mainstream media, which at least in principle commissioned to promulgate the government's lies. This is how circular, self-serving propaganda operates between official authorities and the media. Today, we're witnessing the same strategy being used on a national scale for the rollout of 5G wireless technology, genetically modified foods, and the push for national and state vaccination mandates. In every single case, the messenger is highly biased, compromised by ulterior motives, and intentionally ignores volumes of sound scientific literature and analysis that would undermine their falsehoods. With respect to advancing vaccination mandates, the mainstream magazines, newspapers, and television use similar talking points to reinterpret and to misrepresent facts to strengthen the agendas of private interests at the expense of bolstering public knowledge that might make society more immune to propaganda serving private commercial interest. Lie repeatedly enough to readers, and you'll win their allegiance. The circular reasoning of vaccination policy begins with the government health agencies announcing there's no connection whatsoever between vaccines and autism or any other neurological disorders. Trust us, we know best. The science, we are told, is conclusive. This discussion is over. Vaccines are safe. All vaccines are therefore rubber-stamped as safe and effective, and this is the fundamental message the CDC's educational campaign to journalists. Yes, it has an educational propaganda campaign of giving out articles and literature that the journalist has to just put their name on and they can publish it. This is true for all health reporters. Anyone who questions this commandment is mistaken, and anyone who actively disseminates true information to the contrary is an enemy to the public. Dutifully, the media chants the CDC's creed. Health officials and private vaccine makers' public relations efforts then reinforce the media to further validate their disinformation campaigns. The CDC and the FDA decide who are the acceptable spokespersons, such as Paul Offit and law professor Dorit Reese, to be invited onto the mainstream media to warn the public about the dangers of vaccine opponents. There's no debate. Overarching, ambiguous pronouncements are made about so-called scientific consensus, about vaccine safety, and rarely is any substantial scientific research actually referenced. We are not told that over $4 billion have been awarded to victims of vaccine injuries and deaths, including neurological disorders, including autism. Imagine the confusion if you're the average person doing your homework. The FDA and the CDC, there is no such thing as a vaccine autism connection. Then you go over to the Justice Department that handles the VARs, or the damaged recipients of vaccines, and they say, oh yeah, we've had a lot of people that we've given money to who've been vaccine damaged with autism and neurological disorders. So which is it? One and two and three agencies say nothing is wrong with vaccines, and the other one is paying out all this billions of dollars, and this is not an easy court to get into. There's no process for appeal, and they actually use Justice Department lawyers to try to challenge the victims. This is not an open and friendly, let's take a look at your injuries and see if vaccines were involved. This is arduous. So this reveals the influential power that the federal health agencies have in collusion with the pharmaceutical industry's financial interest to silent opposition. And this is the same strategy that was used to get us into the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, into Libya, changing regimes around the world, including down in Venezuela, also in Honduras. In fact, 81 countries the United States since the end of World War II has engaged in regime change as a matter of policy if it does not meet with our needs, our ecological, or economic and political agenda. So it's not up for debate. Did we undermine the democratically elected populist land-reforming president of Honduras, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton? Of course we did. But you wouldn't know that from the media, would you? You wouldn't know our Gloria Nuland over at the State Department. And she is married to the most powerful neocon in Washington, D.C. that you rarely hear of. And they have an agenda. You wouldn't know America participated in that. You wouldn't know that Libya posed no threat to his own country, let alone the world. You wouldn't know that. And that's not by chance. So from Vietnam to today, the story is the same of how people in power have captured the media to use it to its own advantage, and special interest groups as well. The most common repeated mantra is that vaccines are safe and do not cause harm. In 2000, the CDC's Veristatin study concluded a relationship between the mercury preservative thimerosal used in most vaccines at the time with the onset of autistic disorders. The CDC officials, along with pharmaceutical executives, and we're talking about executives from companies that manufactured vaccines, they all met. And they met for a reason. There was panic. They also invited the World Health Organization and the British Health Ministry to come, because lo and behold, the Veristatin study on 220,000 children showed a statistically significant increase in autism spectrum disorders. So the proof was there. It was only after civil rights attorney Robert Kennedy Jr. made public the Simpson Wood transcripts, after filing a Freedom of Information request, that we now acknowledge the CDC and its co-sponsors acted with criminal intent. But have you seen this investigation by any of the pro-vaccine media? Not one. Years later, just a few years later, in fact, a senior scientist at the CDC, Dr. William Thompson, admitted to an independent biology professor with a vaccine-injured son, Professor Brian Hooker, that the federal agency had been engaging in an egregious cover-up of medical evidence that the measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, contributed to a higher rate of autism in African-American boys, and that the thimerosal lace flu vaccine was associated with a higher incidence of neurological tics, involuntary twitches, and spasms that are defining symptom of Tourette syndrome. Several published studies, including one authored by Dr. Thompson himself and published in 2007 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, have shown this relationship. A subsequent 2012 study confirming the same was published in the Journal of Pediatric Psychology. So, it was a 324% increase in autism spectrum disorder in boys 36 months and younger who are African American. Now, with all the high-quality, intelligent, and well-resourced journalists in the United States who have thick Rolodexes and can find the truth if they want to, why is it that it took Robert Kennedy to bring this to our attention and Brian Hooker to reveal this, and not a single news media covered it? It was a non-event. Two separate major studies, both proving autism spectrum disorder, both from the MMR vaccine, and yet not a word. Both of these revelations about the measles and flu vaccines were devastating enough to prompt CDC officials to gather all the scientific data for destruction. They were to be put into black garbage bags and incinerated. Dr. Thompson attempted to warn the CDC director at the time, Dr. Julie Gerberding, regarding this relationship. Prior to a February 2004 Institute of Medicine meeting on vaccines and autism, rather than allowing Dr. Thompson to present the information at this meeting, Dr. Gerberding replaced him as a speaker with Dr. Frank DiStefano, current director of the CDC's Immunization Safety Office, where he presented fraudulent results regarding the MMR vaccine and autism. Dr. Thompson was put on administrative leave and was threatened that he would be fired due to, quote, insubordination. But had he told a lie? No. He was informing everyone up the chain of command, which is a military command at the CDC, that there was a very high incidence of autism in African American children. And it was being covered up intentionally, meaning with malice, by operatives working within the CDC. He was threatened and he was challenged. As a result, no media covered this story. Even when it has become known, no media has covered this story. You have not seen 60 Minutes try to speak with Dr. Gerberding, who went to work for Merck, the maker of the MMR vaccine, at a multi-million-dollar contract immediately after that. Well, that's a good story for Dateline 2020 or in these other investigative journaling shows. Dr. Thompson secretly withheld copies of the incriminating documents, which were later provided to Professor Hooker and to Representative Bill Posey of Florida, who has championed the cause of freedom for medical choice regarding vaccination. It is estimated that Dr. Thompson released more or less 10,000 documents. Despite efforts to have Dr. Thompson testify before Congress under oath, and therefore bring in all the other people, including Dr. Gerberding, to testify under oath, virtually every attempt has been thwarted by the CDC. The myth of vaccine safety today clearly trumps the health of the nation. And in the meantime, serious childhood neurological disorders increase dramatically, and our federal officials scramble to find answers everywhere other than the truth, the 50 vaccine doses children receive before the age of 6. Certainly, all of this immunization, which contains genetically altered live and inactivated bacteria and viruses, toxic chemicals such as formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid, polysorbate 80 as a preservative, heavy metals like aluminum, antibiotics, and human and animal and insect DNA and RNA cannot be injected into a child without medical risks, either known or unknown. Frankly, it is ethically irresponsible to blindly believe such a toxic stew is completely safe to inject into young, developing children. Our federal health agencies have yet to conduct or fund definitive studies with legitimate methodological outcomes. No, they haven't done that at all. So, what we're doing now is playing Russian roulette with our children's futures and health. Worse, history of the pharmaceutical industry's vaccine clinical trials is virtually non-existent. They have no viable gold standard double-blind studies with a legitimate inert placebo, such as saline solution. Yet this is exactly what a recent editorial in Scientific America's June 24, 2019 issue wants readers to believe. the article entitled "The U.S. Needs to Tighten Vaccination Mandates," states, quote, "There isn't an iota of doubt that vaccines are a safe and effective way to prevent many diseases." Well, back at ya. No scientific evidence whatsoever to raise doubt. Are you kidding? Despite a Supreme Court ruling that states vaccines are, quote, unavoidably unsafe. Perhaps more disconcerting is that the essay was written by the magazine's editors, meaning this is now Scientific America's official policy statement regarding vaccination, rather than being the opinion of a single author. In effect, the magazine is telling its readers that it stands firmly behind the CDC's propaganda machine, and we should never expect to see any scientific evidence that challenges the magazine's vaccine dogma within its pages. Now, mind you, this is the same racist CDC that did the 40-year Tuskegee experiment, allowing hundreds of African Americans who had syphilis to go untreated, like they were human guinea pigs, to see the outcome. And now this same racist organization is saying we don't want the world to know, especially the African-American community, that there is a 324% increase in autism in boys 36 and under taking the MMR vaccine. Every African-American Congress should be outraged. They're not. Every African-American person in the United States who's a pediatrician, a scientist, someone involved, a chemist, should be outraged and not give the MMR vaccine until absolute, independent, gold standard proof that it's safe and effective is produced. They're not. We send information out to churches, African-American churches, saying, this is important for your congregants. It wasn't. So where are the voices within the African-American community speaking out against the CDC? Where are the rallies? Where is there pressure upon their legislators to hold these committees, hearings, and bring forth the man who will show that the same racist policies they used with Tuskegee, that Bill Clinton finally had to apologize for, is still occurring? Think of that for a moment. If we can find our voice, rightly so, to call out racism where it exists, and it should be, why is the voice stilled when it comes to African-American children today? We need to think on this, shouldn't we? But we're not. And so I have to ask the editors of Scientific America, is this how you're becoming less scientific in recent years on some issues? The effort to silence all vaccine criticism, including attacking reputable scientists and physicians and attorneys such as Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who defend the rights of vaccine-injured children, has been full throttle on Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Wikipedia. The article repeats many of the CDC's lead talking points to promote a medical regime that will eventually enforce mandatory vaccination upon a nation, thereby making state laws ineffective. The magazine editors' key points are, unvaccinated children and their parents are to be blamed for recent infectious disease epidemics, notably the 2019 measles outbreak. Well, let's back up a moment and let's dissect this misinformation. First, measles is not an epidemic disease. It is simply a body infection. And in 20 years, there were only two deaths, with a population more or less between 327 and 330 million people. And now when you have the measles infection, it's not a disease, and you recover, which 99.999999% do, then you're immune for life. And also, what about all those people who had measles, it turns out, had the measles from the measles vaccine, because it turns out that the toxicoid in the measles vaccine can actually create measles. It's actually in the manufacturer's package insert. So they're wrong on all their facts. Now, if you want to talk about an epidemic and to go after it, how about the epidemic of young people committing suicide? How about the epidemic of women 25 to 45 taking antipsychotic and antidepressant medications? How about the epidemic of a diabetes, prediabetes, heart disease, cancer, stroke, arthritis, the epidemic of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? Those are legitimate epidemics. We have not yet had an epidemic of measles in the last 60 years. They also want us to believe that unvaccinated persons and those who oppose vaccine mandates are a national threat to public health. All right, let's just take a look at that for a moment. 99% of the people that I've spoken with who had a vaccine-injured child fully supported vaccines. They hadn't done any homework, including board-certified pediatricians. Then their child died. That was in several cases of physicians who vaccinated their own children. They died, and or the general public. And then they become very focused on doing their homework. So how is a mother who's a board-certified pediatrician, whose child died because of the vaccine, how is she a threat to American society? She's an educated woman, so you're going against her education and you're going against her gender. She's a victim, so now you're blaming the victim. You're punishing a person that's lost the most precious thing in their life, their child. Where's the movement to protect women who are talking out about being damaged by vaccines? It doesn't exist. So now they're the enemy, and we should fear them? Because you know where this goes, don't you? Once you fear someone and you consider them a threat, then suddenly the state steps in and says, this person is no better than local terrorists. We had better keep an eye on them because they're capable of hurting society. See, if you don't understand history and how fascism works and has historically, then you are overlooking the power of words used pejoratively against a group of people who are first victims. And now you're institutionalizing, codifying the legitimacy of your attacks against them. We're also told that the nation must achieve herd immunity in order to once and for all eradicate infectious disease. Please show me. I've spent about 18,000 hours researching this. Show me the articles from the peer-reviewed literature proving herd immunity. You can't. They don't exist. Herd immunity, you tell us, can only be reached by full compliance. Well, I can show you countries and I can show you places where they had full herd immunity, didn't stop people from developing the diseases to which they were vaccinated. They also condemn the internet. It's the main source for proliferation of information that questions vaccine efficacy and safety. Yes, it is one that questions the lack of safety of 5G. It also questions the safety of genetically modified foods and glyphosate. It was not the media, nor was it the government, nor was it the manufacturing sector that questioned glyphosate. It was we, the people, we lay people and we journalists and we scientists who decided to take a look at something, and we found it. And now it's been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, and lawsuits have been filed. So the internet is also used as one of the last ways of getting quality information since you refused to publish it in the scientific journals. Also, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, they say, a former gastroenterological researcher at the Royal Hospital in London, is largely to blame for the increase in vaccine hesitancy. Well, let's deal with these now. Behind these messages, the Scientific America is softly advocating widespread censorship of information that questions vaccine safety. This would have to include numerous peer-reviewed studies and analysis that show vaccines in fact cause a large variety of mental and physical adverse effects. And if they haven't taken the time to read the toxicological peer review journal, we have several 3,000 or 4,000 studies we can share with them. and the biological pathways behind the cause of these injuries are now known. If vaccine opponents can be silenced or blacklisted from search engines and social media, then the public would never know about the scientific literature that exposes vaccines' flaws, and the mythic herd immunity can be reached unimpeded. The medical and immunological research that uncovers vaccine injury causation would be buried in obscurity because no pro-vaccine advocate would agree with the Scientific American's official policy would ever reference them. It is therefore inconceivable that the Scientific American and numerous other popular publications, the major media networks that are fully beholden to the CDC and the drug industry, would print new research challenging politically correct claims about vaccine safety. This is one reason why the anti-vaccination community is so essential at this time to keep the public debate on vaccine efficacy and safety alive and to prevent a national vaccination mandate being implemented and based upon bias and unscientific, unsound principles. It has only been through the diligent motivations of vaccine truth seekers who perform exhaustive research in the scientific literature that an alternative vaccine story reaches public light. Readers are encouraged to visit any of the leading anti-vaccine websites and read the articles in the archives that consistently analyze and reference very specific peer-reviewed studies buried in the esoteric world literature on medical issues. And then you'll see they have come across a motherload of science that questions the safety and efficacy of vaccines. The editorial revisits the old yarn that to condemn Dr. Andrew Wakefield in the typical fashion of misrepresenting the facts of both the court case and his research in the medical journals, The Lancet. On no occasion during the lead-up to his being discredited by the British court did Dr. Wakefield make the claim that the measles vaccine caused autism, not once, in any of the children enrolled in his research. I think there were 12 children. His Lancet paper focused on gastrointestinal inflammation in the mitochondria that is not an uncommon condition in autistic children. Wakefield's study reported on the presence of MMR's viral component embedded in the children's gut. His conclusion was that this may be the causal factor for the GI disorders in certain children on autism spectrum scale. However, today with the U.S.'s latest autism rate at roughly 1 in 40 children, except for New Jersey, that's not surprising. Over there in New Jersey, you've got 1 in 34 kids who are who have autism, and you're opening the floodgates for even more mandatory vaccines. So, and they will seek out answers to understand why their children are damaged. This is a crisis our federal health agencies are criminally ignoring. However, any qualified reporter or journal editor could have determined that Dr. Wakefield was only one among a team of scientists, and none had stated that the MR vaccine caused autism, but recommended further research be performed. Collectively, Lancet paper's authors had published numerous papers earlier and were all vaccine advocates. They were pro-vaccine. The paper was retracted, and the two lead authors, Dr. Wakefield and his superior, one of the greatest scientists in the world, Dr. John Walker Smith, were subsequently charged with scientific fraud and had their medical license revoked. Well, Dr. Walker Smith appealed, and the highest British court exonerated him completely and stated its disapproval of the British Medical Board behavior and the court ruling. The court's ruling, in effect, said that the entire case against Dr. Wakefield was unfounded. And yet, today, Scientific America clearly did not get the message, nor over at CNN, with their constant attack against him. The irony is that Dr. Wakefield's research is rarely mentioned or referenced any longer within the anti-vaccine community. Why? Well, that was an earlier generation. Yet the corporate-friendly media continues to highlight it repeatedly as central to its arsenal of propagandist fodder. The new generation of parents with vaccine-injured children is far savvier and more educated, and they mine the body of scientific literature incessantly. They know far more about vaccine ingredients and their toxicological properties than their pediatricians and primary doctors. If an honest public debate on vaccine safety were to be held, many of their parents would turn the Scientific America pro-vaccine editors into biased amateurs. In conclusion, It may also be noted that Scientific America's chief editor, Marriott DeChristina, has some relationships that raise serious questions about her scientific objectivity. She has been lauded, praised by the small medical cult of radicalized militant skeptics in the scientific-based medicine who dominate Wikipedia. And that is the reality. And also, she was behind the stopping of the Brazilian issue that was favorable towards agricultural homeopathy. As the magazine's chief editor, she was on record for stating that homeopathy, quote, is pseudoscience. That's strange. I should send her the article that's showing it. It has a lot of qualified science supporting it. But that's a common term used by followers of skeptical medical materialism to denounce non-conventional medical theories and therapeutic practices. She's also favorable towards the Gates Foundation, the world's wealthiest, most aggressive philanthropic funds of vaccine research and development and for founding vaccine programs in developed nations. This year, DeChristina attended the World Economic Forum in Davos and interviewed the foundation's president of global health, Trevor Mundell, about the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. That's the largest international endeavor of its kind to create vaccine platforms for rapid response to infectious illness disease outbreaks. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.